Okay, why don't we get started? Are we all set? AV's all set? Good. So I've got three or four things I want to do tonight. I'm going to go over assignment one briefly now, and then handed out solutions, and if you have time, if you have questions about it, then maybe we can pursue that after one of the breaks when people have had a chance to kind of look at it and think about it. And then I want to finish chapter one, which we're almost done with, of the slides. Then I'm going to talk about shadowing, which is a recovery technology you're going to need for the first couple of steps of the project. And then we'll get into the beginnings of concurrency control, which is chapter two of the slides. It's sort of chapter six of the textbook, but it's unfortunately, there's nothing really written about the initial material, the first section of the slides. So actually that material is on the slides and nowhere else. So that's basically the agenda. So normally I would start out with questions, but I think I want to do assignment one first, and then I'll march through things in the sequence I just described. So just as background then, for assignment one, the reason again to present this was to start getting you to think about the kinds of issues that are at stake in getting an implementation of the transaction asset properties to actually work. This is not a particularly good implementation. There's nothing about this algorithm that is super interesting as some variation on a useful recovery algorithm. Its main feature is that it's simple, and that with hardly any background other than being able to read a procedure and understanding the asset properties, you can start to think about those issues. So all of what I'm about to say is in the solution, I think, but let me just, as a way of stimulating any questions you might have, let me just give you a quick overview of what's going on. The start operation is returning a transaction identifier, which is a negative number, and which is a negative number here, and then the read operation first of all, it's checking to see if the block is already in cache, and if it is, it's tagging that block with the identifier of the transaction that's doing the read over here, and then it's returning the a pointer to the block, pointer to the block over here, and returning success. If it's not in cache, then the else part gets executed, and this is where the data is actually read from disk. The value that's read is read into the old block. There's two copies of the block in memory, old block and new block. So it's copied into the old block, and then from there it's copied into new block. So initially they're identical. And the idea is that as the transaction runs, it's going to only update the new block value with the expectation that if the transaction should abort, you still have the old block value to go back to. Right, that's basically keeping two versions of the block, and we'll see an example of another algorithm like that in a bit. And then it returns a pointer to the new block, which is the same as what it would have done if it had already been in cache. And then, as was pointed out by one of you, there's actually a missing line of code here where the block address of the cache needs to be assigned as a pointer to the block on disk. Otherwise, it's just going to be left over from the previous execution. It turns out, if you didn't notice it, it probably doesn't get you into any trouble because none of the handshakes about old and new values actually are affected by that. It's just obviously the bookkeeping of what's in cache requires it. then if a transaction writes into a block, what it does is it just writes directly into this new block area all by itself. There are no function calls to do that. It's just directly writing into new block. And after it's done writing into new block, it tells the cache manager that the new block has in fact been updated by calling write, which has the effect of storing the transaction ID into that block, whereas before, is this a minus here? Should be a minus. Has to be a minus, right? Because it's already. No, maybe it's okay. Let's see. We'll see in a second. So it's tagging it with the ID of the transaction that wrote the block, which is a negative. Okay, which is a negative number. All right, that's where I'm getting confused. Which is a negative number. So now we know that the new block part of the cache block has been updated by this transaction, and later on the transaction is going to commit or abort. Well, let's do. Doesn't really matter. Let's do abort first. So if the transaction aborts, then what it's going to do is it's going to look for all cache entries, first of all, that that have a positive number here. I guess I have to talk about commit first. Otherwise, that's not going to. I can't really read the abort code. That what commit does is it writes all. It looks for all the cache entries with the transaction ID that the transaction that committed. It's writing the blocks out to disk one by one, and as it writes them, it's marking them by negating the transaction ID tag, thereby kind of leaving a trail saying I already wrote this one out to disk, right? And if at any time if the status, that is if the disk write should fail, returns a status of -1, then it says, oops, well, you know, I'm halfway through the transaction of commit. I only wrote some of the blocks, but not all of them. Therefore, I must abort the transaction. Right? And so at that point, it calls the abort operation to basically go back and wipe out all the updates. It doesn't quite work. We'll see in a second, but that's one possibility. The other is, that's how it. I shouldn't say one possibility. That's how it bails out. But assuming that that it succeeds, then it goes on to the next stage, and it takes the new block, which is the updated block, and it writes it into the old block. Since we're committing the update, right? So we want the old block now to be the latest committed value, which has just been written. And then when we're all done with commit, we just say, well, now that all the updates are committed, we can clear the tag on all of the dirty blocks, all the blocks that have been updated, so that the next transaction that comes along will be able to use them. Now, One thing that can go wrong here, which we'll see the other half of it when I hit the abort code, is that transaction updates two blocks and then starts the commit. During the commit, the first block gets written correctly. The tag gets negated, so it's now a positive number. But because it failed, the status indicator says, oh, it failed. Well, we've got to abort the transaction. So the first one succeeds, but the second one fails, and we have to abort the transaction. And so when we go on to the abort code, what's going to happen is that we're not going to get quite the right state of cache as a result of this. Now, the intent was pretty clear. The intent was that after having updated some but not all of them, abort is going to undo everything and clean out the cache just as if commit had never run, because it was only half executed. But it turns out that isn't quite what happens. So what happened, and the reason is because of this entry right here, that so for the first block, that the one that was already written, It's true that the transaction ID is equal to the negation of the transaction ID. So that means that it has actually been written out. And so the old block is going to be written back out to disk because we've already written the new value out to disk. That was what commit did in its partial execution. And it's writing old, it's taking old block now and writing it into new block so that the cache entry is okay. Now what goes wrong here? Anybody? Yeah.
The blocks that already got written are not reverted if you abort.
Taken? They're not.
The blocks that were already committed to disk.
Right.
And then when the write fails, we call abort, but we don't revert the blocks that in the cache that were already written out. So if somebody wants to read that block now, he's going to read the aborted transactions result.
So this is explained. This actually can happen even without.
Okay. Is it because we are overriding the old block with the new block even the transaction aborts in between? So you are referring to the old block, but you are reading the new content.
Oh.
Yeah.
Could you just put everything back because we stored the old block, right? Instead of only part of it.
Right. I mean, that's so. First of all, I mean, you could do that blindly, right?
Sure.
I mean, you could just run through. You could just run through all of them because the old block you know is okay. So you could write them all out. You could write them all out to disk, even though the disk has not actually been overwritten, and you would be safe. So the problem is if you go back to commit, after writing the first block out as halfway through the commit, it already updated old block to be the new value. So now you've lost, I mean, cache no longer remembers what the before value was of that block. It's already been updated in the cache.
You shouldn't update the old value until the entire transaction.
Yeah, you shouldn't. This statement should come later because so the scenario is the transaction has updated X and Y. During the commit, X gets written out to disk, and old block in memory gets updated to be the new value. Now the second update, when you try to write it, it aborts. So you go in here, and it looks okay. It looks like you're copying old block into new block and making the value the old value again. But you're not, because for the block that has already been written out, old block is actually the new value. Okay. I don't think there's any deep insight in this other than the fact that your mind has to work a certain way. I mean, this is very simple code. I mean, obviously, this is nothing. This is a very, very abstract version of what you would find inside of a real system. And just puzzling it out for, you know, what is it, 20 lines of code or something, is pretty difficult. Another problem that arises, let me see if I get this right, since that this state in abort, this statement that right turns moves old block into new block, it only does that if the transaction actually called the write operation. So suppose a transaction starts running. It reads X, block X. It starts updating new block of X in cache. and then it dies. It just, you know, divides by zero or something. It just dies, and the transaction has to abort. Well, that's fine. It will abort. Some agent will notice that the program has failed, and it will do the abort up here. None of this is going to run because it never called write for any data, in particular for X. It will correctly zero out the cache, the tag on the cache entry for X, but it won't actually take the value of old block and write it into new block to restore it to its original value, because the transaction never actually updated the tag to indicate that it had modified block X. So that's another case where the cache is going to get messed up. So the value is still going to be there, X is still going to be in the cache, and the next transaction that comes along and tries to read it is going to read the value of new block, which is junk. Okay? And there's a couple, there are a number of solutions that could be made for that one as well. Okay, so question.
Sorry, I arrived late, so I'm not sure. Did you talk about ignoring the result of disk read and the read routine?
No. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, in read, if that disk read attempt fails, and the stale data is present in that block.
Yeah, right here.
Then there's a problem.
Yeah, there's no test here. You're quite right. That's not on the solution, and it's absolutely a problem. If there's an error on the read, then the read will still succeed. It will return a value, but it's actually what's sitting in cache is whatever was the last piece of data that was occupying that cache block. Yeah, that's an obvious bug that. Okay. Anything else on this? The effect on the atomicity, isolation, durability properties is in here. That's really just a test of your understanding of the definition. The more interesting part was to actually just start walking through algorithms like this to kind of get a feel for the handshakes that have to happen. Okay? Okay, so let me go back then to chapter 1. I had just covered two-phase commit at the end of the last lecture. Are there any questions about the last lecture? Not about the project yet, because the next piece of tonight I'm going to be talking about that, but yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of hard for me to understand the atomicity because, for example, while you're committing, you could have written something to it, right? But something fails right then in the middle of the write. So something happens, I don't know.
So the issue with atomicity is, in order to interpret it, you have to have a notion of the database state, which is separate from, or which is the piece of the state of the database, which is a piece of the data that's on stable storage, normally disk. Right? So you've got stable storage, which is disk. One of the pieces of the disk has the database. So the fact that during two-phase commit you're writing some of the updates to the disk, to stable storage, does not mean that you've actually put it in the database where it will be regarded as being part of the transaction. And in fact, you better not. So the phase one in two-phase commit is make sure all of the transaction's updates are on the disk, but probably not in the database. Although there's no hard and fast rule. It really depends entirely on how the recovery algorithm works, which is not something we're going to talk about for a bit. We'll see one example of a recovery algorithm actually in a minute. But in the recovery algorithm we're going to go through tonight, then the update that happens during phase one would not go to the database. It would go to the disk, but it would not be in the database. the transaction would commit at the end of phase one because the coordinator, back up here, the coordinator, which switch colors here, sorry, the coordinator, which is actually running this two-phase protocol, after phase one, when it gets an acknowledgement from all of the participants that the transaction's updates are on disk, then it will commit the transaction locally, and then it will go and start telling all of the nodes to actually do the commit, and that is to say, to write the data into the stable database, not just leave it lying around on disk somewhere. And remember, the reason why this is a good thing is if during phase two there's a failure. So the bad situation is I'm the coordinator. I've told all of the participants to put the transactions data on disk. They've all come back and acknowledged that they've done that. I now start saying, okay, commit, commit, and now there's a failure. Either I fail or one of the participants who I want to tell them to commit has failed. Now we're in this bad situation where a couple of the participants have stored the update in the database, but at least one other participant has not. And so this is the violation of atomicity. What makes it okay is that we know for sure that the node that has failed or that no longer knows what the right answer is, whether the transaction committed or not, at least we know it has the updates for the transaction stored safely on disk. It may take a while, but it will eventually recover, and when it does, it has all the information it needs in order to actually install the update in the database. Now, it has to find out what happened. At this point, it doesn't know, right? I mean, if the coordinator failed, it's just sitting there waiting for somebody to tell it whether the transaction committed or aborted. It's got the updates, it just doesn't know whether to put them in the database or not. If it's the participant who failed, then when it recovers, it has to ask the coordinator, hey, what happened while I was down? I've got this update laying around. I don't know whether the transaction committed or not. And the coordinator, assuming it's up, will say, oh, yes, it committed while you were down, so you should put it in your database before you process any more read operations, before you actually come up and get going. So it's part of your recovery routine to get your database back into shape before you start allowing new transactions to run.
Okay. That means the coordinator has to keep that log entry in its log until everybody has committed.
If the coordinator is using a log to keep track of its state in this protocol, then yes, it needs to remember which transaction. For each transaction, it needs to remember whether the transaction committed or aborted until it's sure all of the participants have gotten the required information. Modulo some optimizations, which we'll get to another day. But you know, at this simple level, that's what's going on.
So can the resource managers like roll back even after committing? Because maybe they commit and then another partner fails, and then what?
No, they can't and they won't. Because when the coordinator decides to commit, the transaction has committed. Now, none of the participants at this point know that fact, but the transaction definitely has committed. There's got to be, in every recovery algorithm, there has got to be one write operation to disk of one single disk block that causes the transaction to commit. Otherwise, at recovery time, you wouldn't know. You would have no way of unambiguously determining whether the transaction committed or not. So in every commit algorithm, the first thing to do is to find that write operation, which is the unique write operation that causes the transaction to commit. So first the coordinator commits by writing to the disk, transaction T has committed. Then it starts sending out these messages to everyone. And once it starts sending them out, well, you know for sure it's already committed the transaction. So at that point, there's no chance that after having written the update to the stable database, they might subsequently be asked to roll it back.
So is the prepare step, like the end of phase one, is that like the point of no return?
At the end of phase one is the point of no return. In fact, once a participant has acknowledged to the coordinator that the that it has stored the update on disk, it has basically lost control. It no longer can take action because it doesn't know whether the transaction will commit or abort, and it's not up to him anymore. You know, he had the option of not replying or replying no. I mean, I lost the update. Forget it. But once he acknowledges and says it's on disk, well, it's up to the coordinator to decide. Okay. Let's talk about performance. So performance of a transaction processing system is measured in transactions per second or transactions per minute for some standard transaction type. And there are various benchmarks. The benchmarks keep changing. They changed 2 weeks ago. So happens. So this is going to be a bit out of date, or at least not as up to date as it might be. But and it's also a matter of cost, because it's not just a matter of how many transactions per second or per minute you can run, but also what does it cost to run a transaction. So it's obviously better if you can build a 1,000 transaction per second system for half as much money. That's certainly better. Even though maybe your throughput is no better than the other systems, it's just you can do it for less money. Dollars are measured by the list purchase price of everything, of the hardware and software, plus 5 years of vendor-supplied maintenance, which is called cost of ownership in the benchmarks. The benchmarks are maintained by an organization, sort of ad hoc organization, that was created by the industry back, must have been 1980s. Called the Transaction Processing Council, probably late 80s, I think, and it's a consortium of vendors which gets together to develop and test these benchmarks. So they had a very simple benchmark in the late 80s, early 90s, simple banking benchmark. As hardware got faster and cheaper, that was no longer challenging enough, and so they came up with a more powerful one. And now, as of a couple weeks ago, the same thing has happened again, and now there's yet another one. The workload on these systems is kind of interesting. It's mostly in the database system, which maybe is not surprising when by the time you're done with this course and you realize I'm spending half the time talking about database systems, but just a very particular part of the database system, which is important for the asset properties and for performance of the transaction. But a lot of it is in the communication system, and the application code itself actually doesn't do very much. So it's really mostly in the guts of the system where you're spending resources. Now, the benchmarks I'm going to talk about are actually obsolete now.
That 50% DB, how much of that is operating system and how much of that is database?
Well, a lot of the database system path is in the operating system doing I/O. But special kind of I/O though, you know, for the database. So it's, you know, you could say it's in the database in the operating system, but that doesn't, assuming that you've optimized path length for being able to issue IOs, that really doesn't say very much, because it's really the database system is pretty much under control of how much operating system overhead you're going to experience for a lot of it, because it's messages, counting messages and counting IOs to disk. So the benchmarks are obsolete, but they're really interesting because not so much because they're used in order to actually compare systems these days, but rather because they give you a feel for what is a challenging transaction application. You know, where do you run into performance trouble? And even though people know how to circumvent these problems now, you don't, probably. You probably wouldn't be taking the course. So therefore, I think that sort of looking at these applications and understanding what's challenging about them is a useful exercise. So the TPC-A benchmark was created based on a benchmark. I think it was actually developed at Bank of America. It was a variation of one that they have used in order to compare systems. and it it's managing bank accounts, checking accounts. So there's a set of accounts and bank tellers. The tellers, like teller machines, are in bank branches, and there's a history of transactions that's being maintained. So your standard transaction reads a message. That message says to add or deduct money from a checking account. And so what you have to do is read the record for that account, and of course, eventually you're gonna update it. You then have to record. Whoops, I didn't want to do. You didn't see that, but my machine is acting up here. Operator error. You then want to write a history record to indicate that the update has actually happened. You then want to update the amount of money that's sitting in the teller's cash drawer, because you've either taken money out or you've deposited money into the cash drawer. And then, for purposes of the benchmark, nobody would ever really do this in practice, you want to update the amount of money in the bank branch. And the reason for that is it becomes a very, the technical term is hotspot, but what it becomes is it's a source of conflict for updates, because all of these tellers are taking deposits and withdrawals, and all of them are trying to update this bank branch balance. And they have to synchronize those updates, and eventually that becomes a potential bottleneck. Similarly, the history record, all the transactions are trying to add a record to the end of the history file. And so the end of the history file can become a bottleneck where they have to synchronize access. The read and write operations of the account record test your ability to do random access across the database. And that data is actually pretty cold. The chances of having two transactions update the same account record on a large database is very small. On the other hand, if you're inefficient about the way you do the updates, you're going to be doing a lot of I/O in order to do those random operations. There are ways of optimizing that in order to reduce the amount of such operations, or at least to load balance across the disks a little better so that you don't end up overusing any one of them. So that was the original TPC benchmark. There are two versions of it, one with terminals and one without. After a while, what they found out was because the systems got so big and the ability to run them, run high throughput got so big, that the total cost of ownership was dominated by the cost of the terminals that were hooked up in order to drive the system. So dollars per transaction per second were actually mostly measured by how cheap was the cheapest terminal that you could sell in order to run this benchmark, because it had to be, you know, something on the price list that you were selling. So at that point, people stopped. They stopped with the A version that had the terminals, and they just ran the B version for a while, which was just you could feed the requests in any way you wanted. They didn't have to actually have a terminal network out there that was feeding in the requests. But then even that eventually got to be too easy. Although, you know, I remember back in the early 80s, people were talking about how long it was going to take before we could hit 1,000 transactions per second. You know, now for this benchmark, you could probably run 1,000,000 transactions per second. I don't really know how big the scaling could go, but it was pretty big, I bet.
Are the contents of the messages in this benchmark standardized, or are they random?
Oh, they're standard. Everybody, all the messages coming in have the same format.
Well, but the values, because if the values are standard, it's very easy to write an optimized path for TPCA that knows the first guy is going to deduct a dollar and the second guy is going to...
Oh, no benchmark specials.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it has to be generic code, yeah.
But so if these database tables aren't really too big, right, if you keep them all in memory, then all these random accesses are not really... random disk access. All you're doing is sequential writing to the disk, right?
Right.
In practice, I mean.
Right. So there are all these benchmarks have some scalability factor that basically ensures the data is going to be on disk. Otherwise, your cost is going to go through the roof because of the cost of main memory. Now, you know, you're talking about a certain point in time, so. But over time, that keeps happening. Is that you know, the disk arms don't get that much faster, main memory keeps getting cheaper, and you get more and more incentive to keep the more of the database in main memory in order to get the best cost performance. You know, those numbers are changing all the time. Yeah.
Did they force flushing file buffers on the disks?
Yes. So we're going to get into that. We're going to talk about that a lot in this course, but the issue here is that before the transaction commits, all of its updates need to be on disk, right? Because the moment it commits, that's it, right? I mean, if the system fails, the results have to be durable. That's what the asset properties say. So there's going to be a lot of forced writing to the disk in order to get the asset properties. And that's obviously going to be not very good for performance. You know, that you're sitting around pushing stuff out to disk and waiting for the disk to acknowledge, and especially if it's random writes to the disk, which in some of these cases it will. I mean, these account records are spread over a large number of disks, so you're going to have to write them back out to where they were. A lot of random forced write operations. Not a good thing. We're going to talk a lot about how to avoid that.
So we were saying that the sequential access was kind of the bottleneck, or it could be the bottleneck here. Couldn't they do like a random access there, right? I know history sequential, but they could like have some kind of hash or something in the disk and then order it later, right?
Yeah, there's lots of things like that one can do, and we will, you know, we'll get into all of that. Some version of logging, basically, to turn random I/O into sequential I/O is sort of what it boils down to. Okay, let me just move on, talk about TPCC, which is what followed. So the next step was to basically make a benchmark that required a lot more computation so that the numbers didn't get so crazy and you didn't have to build such a big system in order to be able to really test out its performance. So TPCC is an order entry benchmark that keeps track of orders, and it's got a bunch of different tables which are listed here, description of warehouses, districts, customers, etc. The new order table, which is getting an entry for each new order. And an order is built out of order lines. You know, you get an order, and it has an order header, which has all the information about the overall order, you know, the customer and the billing address and all of that. And then underneath, there's a bunch of line items for all the things that have been ordered. And those appear in the order line table. All right? And each order line corresponds to ordering some particular item that's in the catalog, presumably that it's in the stock table, you know, so you know how much stuff is in stock. All right, so the critical transaction type is new order, which, if you just read it, you can see does a fair bit more work than the banking transaction we did before. It's getting information about a warehouse, customer, and district. It's updating the district. It's incrementing the order number. It's inserting a record into order in the new orders table, and then it's getting a bunch of items and updating the stock record for the items that have been ordered and put them in the order lines table, and then finally commit. Moreover, for every one of these new orders that run, there's a bunch of other transaction types that run at a certain ratio. I don't remember them offhand. They're in chapter one of the textbook, which you've already read. But it basically tells you what the ratios are between them. So what you're really counting is new order transactions, not these other transactions underneath. But that is what adds to the load. You know, it doesn't really tell you how fast your application is going to run, but it at least gives you some feeling for what the cheap systems are or what the high-performance systems are, or if you're tied to a particular vendor because you don't, you know, you do most of your business with IBM, you know, that you want to find, at least get an idea of what you're buying is sort of within the right ballpark, that it's not, you're not overpaying by too much by just looking at, you look at the benchmark and, well, if I shift it to HP, I mean, it would end up being about the same anyway. For a comparable system, or not, in which case you go hassle your vendor about their pricing. So these were some TPCC numbers. I mean, they've still been running them up until very recently, so you can get a feeling for them. One of the things that that I'm going to ask you to do this week in the assignment is to go to the TPC website and browse these numbers just to get a feel for kind of what's there and what they mean to try to understand them. You'll see that that the numbers are pretty sensitive to the date submitted. They do retire numbers, but they have benchmark numbers going back pretty far. Recent numbers for recent transaction types, you'll see something like between $1 and $6 per transaction per minute. So a system that's got 1,000 transactions per minute throughput, then would be... No, this isn't going to work. What I'm trying—the calculation I'm trying to do isn't going to work because it's a five-year system cost. So, the system costs range anywhere from $27,000 to $12 million. And there's different markets, right? It's sort of if I buy a small, you know, what's the cheapest system I can buy that's going to run a good load versus I've got this unbelievably huge load. Who's got a system that's big enough to handle it at any price? And then there are points in between. So, an example here: I've got an IBM system that is $12 million for the system. It's about $3 per transaction per minute, and it runs about it does divide out and runs about 4 million transactions per minute. I'm not sure what I was confused about earlier. So the price and the price divided by the transactions per minute gives you the price per transaction. And that's actually a pretty interesting number because the transaction usually is tied to some commercial activity. It's sort of your overhead. It's sort of like the price of doing a credit card verification. You know, if it costs you 10 cents to verify each credit card transaction, you better be making a lot more money on the transaction than 10 cents in order to justify the expense of just being able to do the bookkeeping. Okay. So TPCE is what's coming next. It's a brokerage application like stock brokerage. And I'm suggesting that you skim the spec. I mean, it's out. It's too new. I mean, it was just there are no benchmark results. There's no discussion of it. So I haven't gone through it in enough detail to really comment on it at a high level. But you can get an idea. It's a 300-page document. I'm not asking you to read it all, but I think it's worthwhile to kind of skim it and get a feel for it to see what one of these benchmark specifications actually looks like. Okay. So the last section is on styles of systems, and I just want to say a few words about this. The main point to be made here is that transaction processing is not a component. Most computer systems courses or things that you take are focused around a component, an operating system or a database system or a compiler or a network. This is not about that. This is about an integrated system with lots of different kinds of pieces. So the natural question to ask is, what other kinds of systems are there? You know, if transaction processing is a kind of system, then what are the other kinds of systems? And the answer is there's batch systems, real-time systems, data warehousing systems, and each one of them involves putting together a complete system with many different kinds of products. So when you think about transaction processing, it's in a course like this, I end up having to talk about all kinds of different parts of software. I have to talk about how database systems work. I'm going to have to talk a little bit about how I/O systems work and the buffer manager inside the operating system, because there's a lot of action that happens down there that's important for the transactions. There's middleware. There's communications that goes on, messaging protocols. One of the reasons why people who are just sort of thrown into this business of, you know, somebody gets a job working for an e-commerce company and they've never seen one of these things before, it's very easy to get lost because, you know, there's nothing to put your arms around to say this is it. You know, it's sort of like you get a manual for a thing and you read the manual and you now know how it works. It's not like that. it's really getting an understanding for how all the pieces work together. So anyway, this is written up in the textbook. I think I'm just going to leave it at that, and details you can read there. Okay, that is all I want to say about chapter one. This was the intro. Basically, all the rest of the course is going through the pieces one by one in great detail, uncovering details you never imagined were even there, much less wondering how they worked. I mean, there was nothing to wonder how it worked because you probably never realized that they were even there. But you'll see some of them are very complicated, very interesting. And one of them is recovery, which is what I want to talk about next. So, as I mentioned last time, the courses, organizing the lectures is challenging because I got to synchronize it with the project, and so we're going to jump around a lot. This is listed as section two of the notes. This is section three of chapter seven of the book. So, a little out of order. We're going to be doing a bunch of jumping around like that. But I'm trying to do this in a way that it will be self-contained, so it's not that you missed stuff in between and will be thrown off. But what I want to do is describe a recovery technique that is simple and that will work for you for your project to get started, at least. There are more complicated recovery algorithms that we'll talk about later, and you might want to embellish your project with one of those fancier algorithms, but in order to get started, you've got to have at least one that will allow you to get past the first couple steps so you can get going and get a feeling for how this project is put together. And the technique is called shadow paging. That's the name of it. Okay, so just to remember what it is we're trying to accomplish here. The main goal of shadow paging, like any recovery algorithm, is atomicity and durability. So you might ask, what about consistency and isolation? Well, consistency, you will recall, is in the province of the application program. It's supposed to maintain consistency of the data. So that we don't have to worry about in this course. It's an application programming problem. Isolation is all about synchronization of access to shared data. In a word, locking is what it's all about. We're going to talk a lot about locking. Hours and hours we're going to be talking about locking in lecture. But that's not recovery. Right now we're going to focus just on the atomicity and durability parts, which means we're going to basically be assuming we're running one transaction at a time. Now you can kind of see why assignment one is what it was. Sort of get you thinking about the recovery issues of running one transaction at a time. Because you'll see there's plenty to understand about recovery even in that very simple execution model. So the problem is the only hardware operation that you have available, which is atomic with respect to failures, is write a disk block. That's it, right? I mean, if you think about it, there's nothing else in the computer system that's resistant to failure, right? If you write the disk block, you know, the lights go out, you know, you boot everything up again, you run a program that takes a look at the disk block and finds out what's there. I mean, that's the only way you can possibly know whether something did or did not happen. Now, maybe not disk. I mean, it has to be some form of stable storage that's resistant to operating system failures, so that it's not going to get corrupted because there was some out-of-bounds memory update, and that it's all or nothing, that, you know, there's some hardware that's going to make sure, it, you know, there's no ambiguity when you look at it. Did it happen? Didn't it happen? Well, you know, it has to be either it did or it didn't. Now, if the database fit on one disk block, this would be easy. Now you laugh, but people, the initial airline reservation systems, that's how they were built. You know, everything there was to know about a single reservation was stored on one disk block, because this was 1965. Nobody understood this stuff. I mean, this was like the first attempt at building something that would just work. So, you know, they did the obvious thing, which was all the information about a reservation fit on one disk block. You wrote it out. It was either there or it wasn't. End of story. But over time, they realized this is not going to work, because there's shared information that's relevant to multiple reservations. Like, how many seats are on the flight? Well, that's okay, provided you can get all the reservations for each flight on one disk block. Now, you're still okay. But eventually, of course, this just unravels. You just can't keep track of all this information in one place. You've got to spread it out. So you have to accept the fact that a transaction is going to update more than one disk block. That is a fact of life. So, in a nutshell, here's how it works. The database is a tree of pages out on disk. There's always at least one copy of the tree, and sometimes there's a second copy of the tree while a transaction is running. And that second copy while the transaction is running is called a shadow copy. All the updates that the transaction makes are going into this shadow copy. It's out there on the disk, but it's a shadow copy. If at any time anything fails and you come back up, the shadow copy will be ignored. Only the master copy counts. At the very end, when the transaction is all done and its shadow copy is perfect, all of its updates have been done correctly, they're out on disk, you swap the roots. And the root of the shadow copy now becomes the master. And so it's the write operation to the root of the tree which causes the transaction to commit. Until that write operation happens, that shadow is just a bunch of garbage on the disk. The moment that that write operation goes to the root, it's the old master that's the garbage on the disk, because the root is now over here. It's a different root. So it's just a pointer swap. Now remember I said, for any recovery algorithm, the thing you got to figure out is where is the operation that causes the transaction to commit. So it's clear what's going on here. It's the update to the root. Okay?
Question?
Yeah.
Does that mean that at the start of every transaction you're making a copy of your tree?
No. That would work, but that would certainly be very expensive. All right? I mean, you've hit the nub of the problem. It's like, how do you do this without actually making a copy of the tree? Right? You've got to do it incrementally. Do I break before or after? Well, it'll take 10 minutes. Let me not leave you in suspense. So the database, let's assume the database is a set of files, and that each file has a set of pages, and each file's content is described by a page table. Very familiar structure you should all be comfortable with. So the file has a page table. We'll identify it by so if it's file F, its page table is F subscript PT for page table. Okay? And the database has a root page, and that root page has a pointer to the page table of every file in the database. And we will assume there's a small enough set of files that those pointers in the database root page, they all fit in one page. So, you know, there might be hundreds of files, but there's not millions of files. Right? It's just there is enough room in that root page to have a pointer to each and every page table, you know, for all of the files. One pointer per file. All right, we're going to run transactions serially, and here's how we're going to do it. So here's the picture, what's going on. We've got the database root here, and it's got pointers to the two files. We've got file A up here, and we've got file B down there, and those are the page tables. And the page table has a subscript here. It's got two subscripts, PT for page table, and then M for master. And there's going to be other subscripts that we'll see there in just a second. And then each entry in the page table for file A is pointing to one page on the disk. So the first page of the file, the second page of the file, the third page, and so forth. Right? Now, the transaction is running in main memory, and it has its own private copies of these page tables. And life is very simple here because we're only running one transaction at a time. We'll deal with the complications later. So if you're running one transaction at a time, there's one copy of these page tables in memory, and initially the page tables in memory are pointing to the same data that the master is pointing to on disk. So we are making a copy of all the page tables here, but we're not making a copy of all the pages. We're still pointing at the pages on disk. And the subscript here, I, mean, whoops, didn't do that very nicely. So the subscript here is this is a page table for transaction I. I is the name of the transaction that's running. And if we had multiple transactions running at the same time, then we would have to have multiple subscripts, multiple identifiers for each one. Okay. So what happens? I write to a page. Transaction writes to a page. What it actually is going to do is it's not going to overwrite the page on disk. It's going to write a new copy of the page on disk, which is a shadow copy of the page. And then it will update its local copy of its page table to point to the shadow copy of the page. Now, it's got to remember which ones it's updated, so it's going to have to mark the entries on the page table to indicate which pages it actually updated, either in the page table or some other structure that sits on the side that identifies them. Right? So the picture now is that transaction I has updated page 2 of file B. So what it did is it read the old copy of file, the old copy of the page, read it into memory, updated it, wrote it back out, and so now we have two copies of page 2 of file B on the disk. The old copy and the new copy. And we have a marker here in main memory that indicates that transaction I wrote into page 2 of file B. Now, if the lights go out and the system comes up, at recovery time, main memory is gone, right? Completely wiped out. Start all over again. The way you start out is you look at the database root, and that's the database. And yes, it turns out there's some other junk sitting out here, like B2 new, but you don't ever reach it by starting at the database root. It's just garbage that's sort of sitting out there on disk that will be ignored at recovery time. Okay? So let's do it again. So now the transaction updates another page. Let's say it updates page 1 of file A, right, over here. So it creates a new copy, reads the old copy into memory, it updates it, it writes it back out, and then it updates its page table with a little marker there indicating that it updated that page as well. So we're only creating extra copies of the pages that have actually been written. We're not making a separate copy of the whole database, as was asked a moment ago. And again, if the system fails at any point, no problem. All those pages that were updated on disk for the new transaction, their shadows, they'll be ignored. Now, how do we commit? Well, the first step is we're going to take the page tables that were in memory and we're going to write them out to disk. So these are the page tables for transaction I, and we've written them out to disk unchanged. All right, so they're pointing to the new state of the database. So for the pages that were not updated, they're still pointing to the old copies. And for the pages that were updated, they're pointing to the new copies. It is exactly the same as the page table we just looked at in main memory, but now it's on disk. The next step is to overwrite those pointers in the root to point to those new page tables. So how do you do that? Well, you read the root into main memory, which is not shown on the slide. You know where you wrote these two new page tables. You know what their locations are on the disk. So you update those entries on the, and this is the root here, it's in main memory. You update those entries for A and B now in memory to point to the new copies. And then you take the root and you actually overwrite the old copy. You don't write it into a different location. You overwrite the old copy. And by overwriting the old copy, which fits in one page, you are installing all the updates in one disk write.
So what happens if the database root doesn't fit on one block?
What happens if the database root doesn't fit on one block? Well, you know, there's an old joke that there are actually very few ways to solve problems in computer science. But most of them can be solved either by a layer of caching or a level of indirection. And this is one, you just add another level of indirection. Just becomes a four-layer tree. Why not?
Question?
Yeah.
So the earlier question was, how do you avoid duplicating the entire tree?
Yeah.
And just looking at the graph, it looks like you duplicated a lot of it. And I just want to understand, the savings here over duplicating the entire tree is just over the actual pages of A2 and B1?
I really disagree that I've modified a lot of it. I mean, these files are probably pretty big. They probably have hundreds, if not thousands, of pages, and you know, there's a lot of them. A given transaction is only updating a couple of pages. We're only going to write back out the page tables for the files that have actually been updated. We don't need to create shadow copies. If there were 100 files and we only updated two, we're only going to write out page tables for the two files that have been updated. So there's a huge reduction in the number of disk writes that we're actually doing as a result of this.
So in your graphic here, this transaction happened to modify most of the files in the database.
Well, it's only because of this, you know, the form factor of the slide, you know, like only fit two files, but yeah.
So in this scenario, right, the disadvantage is that you lead to fragmentation on disk, and when you're reading the next time, right, your performance in reading will be much slower than what it was the first time you wrote all these, right?
Yes.
Because they are just one after another.
Yes.
Now this time you're
asking to repeat the questions.
Yes. Okay. So the question is, won't this algorithm cause fragmentation of the data on the disk? The answer is yes. It's one of the big disadvantages of this algorithm. So, you know, normally when you put the file out on disk, you lay it out contiguously because much of your access to the file is sequential. You know, some of it's random, but you know, you run a query, you know, retrieve all employees in the toy department. You got to scan the entire employee table, all the pages one after the next, to pick out all the ones of who are working in the toy department. And it would be a lot faster if they're all laid out sequentially on the disk, right? So that you don't have to keep moving the disk head. And people do that. Databases are carefully laid out with that kind of sequentiality. But in this algorithm, every time you do an update, you kind of move one of the pages, at least, somewhere else. And so the sequentiality is slowly degraded over time. And it may not be sequentiality. Whatever physical optimization, you know, you carefully did in order to get good physical performance of the disk, whatever that was, it's going to slowly be messed up by the fact that you're doing all of this writing of shadows out there. Yeah, it's one of the reasons why this is not one of the several reasons that this is not a great algorithm. There's actually other, even more pressing reasons, but this one's a pretty bad one. It's all clear? All right. One more.
So if the files are large, then the page table for the file can be larger than a single disk block, right? So keeping copies of A and B might require substantial memory and additional disk space that you would need to write. But I mean, so we could actually keep track of the page table for a file in several pieces, block size pieces.
Yeah. So if the page table is big, too big to fit in one block, you're still okay, provided the total number of blocks of page table
still fits
in the database root.
Right.
I mean, the limiting factor is how many pointers can you put in that database root. So if it's an 8K page and pointers are, you know, 1 byte or 4 bytes, then you know, you're going to get 2,000 of them in a root, probably a little less because it's going to be a header.
Right.
And so even if a given page table had to be stored in multiple pages, that might still be okay as long as you don't go over this hard limit of about 2,000 pointers.
You get to a reasonably complicated state if you have the DB rules spread over different pages and you write out part of it, and then the system fails.
Say that again.
Let's assume the DB rules. So you have another level of interaction, right? So you're forming a tree.
Right.
And you start writing the tree from the root up all the way until you hit the real DB rules.
Yep.
And at some point, if you were to actually fail getting it out, I guess that transaction is
failed. You still got, the transaction's aborted. I mean, you just got all this extra junk on disk.
Yeah, correct.
I'll tell you what to do with that after we break. But you do have, there is some cleanup to do. Because you got to know what blocks are available and which ones aren't. I haven't told you how to figure that out yet. Because every time you write stuff out, I mean, this garbage could be there forever if we don't have a way of dealing with it. All right, we've been going too long. Let's take a break. Come back in 5 minutes or so. Okay. So let's continue. You got the basic idea now of how this works. So let's look at a couple of the variations here. Suppose that two transactions are now running at the same time. And just for isolation reasons, even without getting into any theoretical details, it seems like a bad idea to allow them to update the same block of the file at the same time. So we'll assume that we have two transactions running, and they're updating different pages of the same file. Now, the problem is, who's got the page table in memory? Who's keeping track of what the state of these shadow copies is? Right? So one possibility is you just don't let it happen. If a transaction wants to update a page of a file, it locks the entire file. No other transaction can update pages of the file. It owns the page table for that file in memory until it commits. All right? This is easy to understand. So now when the transaction commits, it only is going to write the page tables of the files that it updated. It has complete control over them, no problem. And it then commits and it releases the files for any other transaction that wants to run. It will work, but it's not great because there's obviously going to be some contention. If you have any popular files that lots of transactions want to update, even at different pages, they're still going to get stuck. So it would be better to allow two transactions to update different pages of the same file. So one way to do this is to have a private shadow... Whoops. What am I doing wrong here? A private shadow copy of each page table per transaction. All right. So if you got two transactions running, they're both going to update pages of file A, then they each get a private copy of the page table for file A, and there's some synchronization that goes on to make sure that they don't update the same page of file A, but they can update different pages of file A. That's okay. Then when the transaction is ready to commit, at that time there's a problem because the copy of the page table that it's working on in memory may not be the most up-to-date copy of that page table for the rows in the page table that it did not update. So what's the scenario here that let's see here. So I've got So I've got two copies of this page table. One for transaction I and one for transaction K. And there's, you know, several entries pointing to various pages. Sorry, I'm very sloppy. Let's see if I can clean this up a little bit. Oh, start again. I gotta get used to this high tech stuff. Okay, have to go. Transaction I, I've got transaction K. And transaction I has updated this first page, and transaction K has updated the second page. And they each have a private copy of this page table for file A in main memory. And now transaction AI commits. So far, so good. So this, you know, gets sent off to the disk, and you know the routine from before, what happens. Everything's fine. The problem is that this entry now for transaction K in memory is obsolete. So even though they were updating different pages of the same file, it's not safe now for this transaction to commit. K cannot commit using exactly its current copy. You basically have two options. One is, at the time that you write, at the time the transaction commits, you go back and you update these entries for all of the other transactions that have a cached copy of page table A. Or you put the burden on the transaction that commits. When transaction K commits, at that time, let me make some space here. At that time, transaction K brings in a second copy of A. This is the one from disk. We'll call that the master. Brings that into memory. And then, because some of the other entries that it didn't update maybe have changed, and it copies in only the entries that actually have changed and leaves the other ones alone. So there's yet another copy of the page table being brought in during commit, because it doesn't know which of these entries that it was uninterested in have changed. Okay? So that'd be another way to do it, probably a better way. Okay. See if I can find my way back here.
Question.
Yeah, question.
So transaction K was working with its own private page table. So it was working with the image of the database before the other transaction I committed. Right? So its ordering essentially is before transaction I. Right? And now when transaction I commits, I mean, now we're reading inconsistent data, right? Because...
No. Okay, so the question is, it seems like we're getting into a serialization problem, where transaction K updated before transaction I, but I committed first, and therefore it looks like the updates are going to go out to disk in a different order. The order in which updates happen in memory is not the order necessarily in which transactions are serialized. Now, I gave you an example of that actually last week, where I had two transactions
I remember, yeah.
That transaction one started before transaction two, transaction one committed before transaction two, but the effective order was that transaction two ran first, because it updated a piece of data that was subsequently updated or read by transaction one, and therefore it looked like transaction one came later. So you've got to be very careful about what this effective ordering is. It's got to do with updates to, it's conflicting reads and writes on shared data is what drives the effective ordering.
If transaction I wrote to the first page, okay, so and the write was committed, right? And now transaction K is reading from that page that was already committed.
Okay. All right. I mean, I'm trying to leave something for you to do on first part of the project, but as long as you ask the question. Did everybody understand the question? So the question is, transaction I updates page 1 of file A and commits. Transaction 2 already has a cached copy of the page table. Transaction 2 then can read page 1 of the file. But its page table is obsolete in entry 1 because transaction I, has already committed a new update on page 1. Right? It's exactly the same as what we saw a moment ago. So now it turns out you've got to refresh even on reads. So maybe you even want to keep another copy. In addition to every transaction's private copy of the page table, maybe you want to actually just keep a master copy of the page table in main memory so that's where you really look to process reads rather than the local. The local copy is just there to keep track of updates. And now you start walking down this path of, well, do I really want to keep a page table at all, or do I really just want to keep track of the pages that have been updated, because if I've got to have a separate copy of the page table in main memory anyway in order to process reads, then all I really need on a per transaction basis is a list of the pages that have actually been updated. It's not the end of the story, but you get the point. What about available space? Well, the list of you see the problem is, if you're going to write these shadow copies to the disk, first of all, you'd like to know that they're going to be garbage collected if the system should fail and subsequently recover. In addition, what are you going to do about the master pages that are being replaced? You know, if I go back to this case here, when transaction I is committed here, wrong color. When transaction I is committed here, it has written a new copy of this page, which makes the old copy garbage, which means we want that old copy to go back into the list of available space, you know, because it's no longer part of the database. How do we do that so that it will be recognized as garbage that can be reused? And the answer is that all you have to do is treat the list of available space as another file. So when you write a new copy of that page, like page A1, you write a shadow copy to the disk. First of all, you grab a copy off of the file, which is the list of available space. You grab a page from that file, which is where you're going to store it on the disk. All right. And as well, at commit time, you're going to rewrite the list of available space to both include the shadow copy, which you have just made part of the database, and to remove the shadow copy from the available space list, which has now become part of the database. As well, the page of the database, which is now being recycled because it's going to go away as part of the database, you now want to add that back into the list of available space. And so, in effect, you're playing the same game with the available space list that you're playing with every other file. You're swapping pages in and out at commit time.
In this case, you're definitely getting into a case where you have to write at least 2 pages as an atomic operation, right?
No, you don't have to write 2 pages as an atomic operation.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Oh, the question is, it seems like I'm getting into a situation where I definitely have to write 2 pages as an atomic operation, which, of course, is impossible, so the answer better be no. But why not? Well, let's go through it slowly. At commit time, well, first of all, while I'm running, I have a master copy of the available space list in memory. Okay? At the time I write page A1 out as a shadow copy, first I look in my list of available space in memory to find an available page. Okay? I mark it as I clear the bit that, you know, that says it's available. I mark it as unavailable, and I mark it as having been updated. by this transaction. And I write page A1 out to that location. All right. In addition, private to the transaction, I remember the fact that I've got this address where A1 old was located, and I remember the fact that that also has to be updated on the list of available space to become a free page at commit time. So at commit time, the way I'm going to update the list of available space is I'm going to read in the current value of the list, or use it in memory if that's what I have, and then update both of those entries on the list. One that indicates the one page has been allocated, the other to indicate the old page has been deallocated, and write all that copy of the list of available space, or that page of the list of available space, gets written out as a shadow copy of the list of available space. Right? And it's going to get swapped just at the same time that the relevant pages are going to get swapped. Now, if you can't all visualize that in your head, make a note to go home and do a walkthrough of what I just said. You know, and draw the picture of updating the list of available space, because this is part one of the project. This is one of those things you have to do in order to get this all to work. You had a follow-on?
Yeah, it was just a follow-on, actually. So that would imply that the page you write to replace the DB root would also be what swaps the available file.
Yes. The DB, when I said that the list of available space is a file in every respect, then what you just said is true. That is that there's a pointer in the root to the current copy of the list of available space, just like there is to files A and B. It's just another file. Yes.
And that update, just like we had before with a critical section, we need a critical section for this available space bit mask in memory, because otherwise you can have the same issue that you had before.
Okay, so the question is, we have critical sections here as well, and yes, there's critical sections all over the place, but if you have two transactions, they're both trying to grab the same free space off this free space list, you have to make sure that doesn't happen. At commit time, the commit operation itself is a critical section. You don't want two transactions committing at the same time, because they're writing different, mutually inconsistent copies mutually inconsistent shadow copies of the available space list to disk, such that neither one of them will be correct after they've both committed. So you have to commit the transactions in some order. Commit one, and then use its copy of the available space list as the basis for committing the next one. You can't commit the two of them in parallel, even though they've updated different pages. It doesn't matter. It's still the list will be inconsistent. Okay?
Another question?
Yeah.
Before you said that eventually we'll talk about concurrency and locking, many hours and all that. It seems like concurrency could really be a problem with this algorithm. So is there, because for instance, you were talking about, you know, how committees happen in critical sections. It seems like if you have multiple shadow trees existing in memory, or on disk, I guess, and one of them commits, it's like you have to invalidate all those other shadow copies somehow to actually continue committing those other transactions. Is that accurate?
No. So the question is, are we going to get into concurrency problems here? Because concurrent transactions are writing shadows to the disk, and as soon as one of them commits, many of the other shadow copies become invalid. No. The reason is, as long as you're doing page... trying not to use technical terms we haven't introduced yet. If each page is only being updated by one transaction at a time, then any shadow copy of the pages it has updated that have gone to disk are independent of shadow copies of pages of any other transaction that's gone to disk. So the only things that are shared are the page tables and the list of available space, which is just another page table. So the thing you have to watch out for is that at the time the transaction starts committing, when it starts writing out those shadow copies of page tables, until it's completed that process and committed, then you don't want to be doing it for another transaction. If you did it for two of them in parallel, then what you said is true. But in effect, the activity of writing out the page tables and ultimately rewriting the root is all one critical section. And that and through that you avoid the problem of ending up with multiple independent shadows of things, some of which become invalid when some transaction commits.
When each transaction starts, until it commits, won't every transaction be told that the next available page on disk is the same for all transactions?
All right. So the question is I'm not sure I know. So if a transaction starts, if you have multiple transactions running, you're worried that they're all going to think the same page is available?
Until the other transactions commit, they're available.
No. Well, yeah. I mean, it could be a problem if you don't bookkeep it correctly.
Okay.
You know, I'm trying to give you a feel for how the algorithm works without acting. I can walk through the solution, but I mean, I want you to actually have to design it. But yes, that's one of the issues you got to think through. So there is one list of available space, clearly. And you do want multiple transactions to be running at the same time, not initially. I think step one says assume one for a while, but eventually you want it set up so that you can run multiple transactions at the same time. And when you do, there's going to be a common list of available space in memory, and you have to bookkeep it so that you don't allocate the same page to two transactions. That would obviously be a bad thing. So, you know, the solutions are not the problem. The problem is dreaming up these problems to realize that there's a problem to be solved. Once you realize there's a problem, you can probably think through exactly what to do about it. But the thing is that it's how do you go through this design in a methodical way to convince yourself that there are no holes, there are no windows, that, you know, and it requires very careful case analysis, very careful thinking, and scenario based thinking about, gee, what if this, what if that, will not get you there. I mean, you'll uncover a lot of problems that way, but you'll do much better if you can find some orderly way, top down way of sort of working out what all the cases are you have to deal with, and then march through them. Or at least at the end, maybe you do it bottom up in the beginning, but eventually you should have some top-down way of convincing yourself that all these possibilities have been taken care of. All right, so one thing is I didn't distinguish between having a transaction update a page and actually write its pages to disk. It's really not necessary that it write the pages to disk right away. It's just that by the time the transaction is starting the commit process, all of its updated database pages must have been written to disk. In other words, you don't want to start writing the shadow page. Once you start writing out shadow copies of page tables, you're delaying other transactions. Right? No one else can commit while this transaction is committing. So you want to get all of the transactions' updated pages to disk before you start the process of writing shadow copies of the page tables. But that doesn't mean you have to write them aggressively, because after all, the transaction might abort. So you have to write them. So I talked about it as if you had to do the writes immediately. It's not really necessary. You can get more concurrency than that. You know, as some of the questions indicated, you know, it sounds like an awful lot of disk writes going on. Yes, there's a lot of disk writes going on. Do not attempt to compete for a TPC benchmark using this algorithm. You will not look good. You've got to do fine-grain concurrency control on much smaller structures than pages. You can't do all of this page writes to random locations on the disk. It's just too slow. But for your project, it's just fine. And you're not obligated to use this structure. And you certainly don't need to use a page abstraction. You can use, you know, there's a natural concept of a record in the project to describe either flight reservation or a hotel reservation, what have you. So you don't necessarily need a page abstraction, and there are certainly design trade-offs here. And you know, to some extent, you're also you're dealing in a contrived environment that we've set up to make it not too much programming, but I'd encourage you to think about this as if it were a real system, you know, and what the real trade-offs are. You know, so you know, simple solutions will look fine in this very simple environment, but if you imagine if I was really doing this and it really was a disk and it really was a lot of data and it really was spread out among lots and lots of pages, then maybe my algorithm would not look that appealing compared to other ways I could have done it. So just a question of how far you want to push that. So is it 7.6? I said 7.3, but I'm pretty sure I checked it, so this is probably right. Let me check right now. No mistakes. Yeah. Yeah, shadow paging is 7.6. You know, I think section 7.6 can be read in isolation. I'm not absolutely sure. If you may find there's a couple of words being mentioned in there that are defined earlier in the chapter. I hope not. I tried to avoid that. But there's also a hand. If you look back in previous versions of the course, like 2005, the last one, you'll find several pages that are extracted from my last book that also cover the same topic. If you like it better, you're welcome to read it. And the original article that described this algorithm, I'm sure, I have no idea whether they really invented it, but it was, I believe, the first place it was written up, is in an article in ACM Transactions on Database Systems back in 1977, 30 years ago. Okay, we've had a lot of questions about this. Are there any more about...
I have a question.
Yes?
Are there any advantages of shadow paging over undo redo? Some advantage? Some basic scores?
I'm sorry, there are advantages for what?
Advantages of the technique of shadow paging over undo redo?
Are there advantages of shadow paging? Well, there is one, which is that when the computer comes back up after a failure, there's no recovery. No recovery required. Right? So if you want to minimize recovery time, this is actually a pretty good way to do things. Now, most systems actually have to run through a recovery algorithm, and while they are recovering, they are not available. So if you had a system that failed very often, like maybe you were, you left, but I mean, maybe you're in the developing world and you have a very unreliable source of power, and you know, if power is going out frequently, maybe even your battery backup can't really be relied upon, then the ability to recover very fast from power failures may be important. So in that case, it would be an interesting algorithm to consider. There are other variations on this algorithm that are a little more efficient that also have that property. But that's the one, I think, the one advantage. From the system implementer's point of view, the big advantage is that you don't have to implement a log or a log recovery algorithm. And both, you know, a log sounds easy. It's a sequential file. Trust me, it's much harder than that. I'll explain why when we get to it. But in addition, the log recovery algorithm is extremely challenging. And so... This is, by comparison, is very easy. I mean, it's still complicated. You have to think hard about the recovery scenarios. So if you're building a system, you're necessarily building a custom data management system. And you don't want to devote too, you know, you don't have a high transaction rate. Maybe you're running transactions. They update a lot of data, but they run for a long time, and you don't have to run them at a very high rate. Then you're going to get by with much less code doing it this way, and probably not sacrifice much in performance because you didn't really need the high performance transaction processing version of this algorithm anyway for your particular usage pattern. So that might be another reason to do it, just less engineering effort. Which, of course, is why I'm suggesting it for the project. We really tried very hard in the project. It's evolved over a period of years. We're trying hard not to make this programming practice. I realize most of you get plenty of programming practice during the day, and you don't need any more. But on the other hand, you got to get down to a level of detail where you really experience problems in order to get a feel for the problems and their solutions. So we're just trying to get you to the point where we're only focusing on the interesting parts, which I hope you'll agree what I just did is one of them. Okay? Any other questions? Okay. Okay, we're doing great here. So, I'm going to start concurrency control. Make sure I'm... Okay. So... this is an outline just for part one. Much of this is covered in chapter six, but some of section two here is only in the slides. It actually is indirectly covered in part of chapter seven in ways that are very hard to explain right now. But the material is simple enough. I hope you'll be able to get everything you need from the lecture, which you'll also need for assignment two. All right, so the subject now is isolation. We want to ensure that we're going to get serializable executions. And we're going to do it inside the data manager, without knowing what the application programs that are running the transactions are actually doing. So you have to think about this from the point of view of the data manager. I'm the data manager. The transactions are running up there at some much higher layer of software. I don't know what they're doing. They're out there in application space. I don't get to see them. But occasionally they send operations my way. And those operations are read, write, commit, abort, start transaction. Basically it. Exactly the ones that you saw in assignment one. That's all I see. My job is to make sure that the transactions execute in a serializable way with that amount of information and no other information. So all I know is what the parameters are to start, read, write, commit, and abort. So I know what's being read and I know what's being written, and I know which operations are part of which transactions. That's all I know. Okay? Now, what are my options? An operation shows up. What can I do? Well, you know, I can either run it, delay it, or reject it. Right? That's about it. So I don't have a lot of choices. So my goal then is using those three actions and no others and whatever little bits of information are in these operations to get the execution to be serializable. You know, when it's stated that way, it's hard to imagine this is such a big topic because, I mean, there's so little information and there's so few things that the implementation can actually do in the end it just doesn't seem like the mechanism could ever get all that complicated. Well, you'd be surprised. Now, for good performance, we want to minimize overhead. By that I mean the mechanism itself that we're going to run to make these decisions of whether to run the operation or delay the operation, that mechanism should not consume too much of the computing capacity, because it's not really doing any real work, right? It's just, it's a control system. It's concurrency control. That's why we call it concurrency control. It's a controller. It's not actually doing work. So that's purely overhead, and you want to minimize it. In addition, you want to minimize delay, because operations come in, you'd really like to run them if possible. I mean, there's a transaction out there that's trying to get work done, and there's a user sitting at a display device ultimately waiting for an answer. And the longer you wait to run the operation, the worse it is for the person sitting at the other end of that display device. Or, if you will, the less capacity the system has, because, you know, you crank it up, basically the more transactions you have running at the same time, the more likely you're going to delay, and therefore the fewer users are going to actually be able to run at the same time and still get satisfactory performance. So it'll either affect response time or scalability, one or the other, maybe both. All right, so first we're going to figure out how to get correct results, and then we'll worry about performance, mostly in part two. That's where the mechanisms get really complicated, is when you try to get good performance. But they're complicated enough even without. All right, so we're going to synchronize read operations and write operations. That's clearly where the action is, because that's all you really know, is which pieces of data are being read and written. We're going to assume these operations are atomic. They're all or nothing. If they weren't, then we would have to synchronize their component operations, which, as it turns out, we really have to do. But we're going to assume we don't. Now, why might we have to do that? Well, when you access the disk, you can only read and write blocks, right? You can only read and write fixed-size pages. But transactions, they're going to read and write records, you know, and you can have lots of records on the page. So the transactions are reading and writing records. The disk is reading and writing pages. I got to translate these reading and writing records into reading and writing pages. And so atomicity may not be automatic here. I mean, it's exactly the problems we just ran into with reading and writing files, where you got different transactions writing different pages of the same file, and you know, you write the page table out, and you end up wiping out the other guy's updates to some of the pages. Sort of the same problem. But we're just going to ignore that. We're going to assume we're going to read and write an entire page. We're going to do this again when we do recovery, because it's hard enough just assuming we're reading and writing a page. So now, at least our operations are atomic. Now, one of the implications of this is when you write a page, you're overwriting the entire page. So you can't just give me a few, you know, I want to update just these bits on the page. You've got to give me an entire page image to write, because I'm only reading and writing pages for you. Obviously, you're the transaction, I'm the database. Am I safe? As a consequence of these assumptions, we're going to be able to write down an execution as a sequence of read and write operations. If it were not the case that read and write operations were atomic, then I could not express or model an execution this simply. I would have to model them based on lower level operations. But we are making this assumption, so this model works fine. So the only operations it can execute, so in fact, let me just look at the notation. We did it last week, but I'll remind you. So we have WK of X. That says that that's a write operation on behalf of transaction K on a piece of data named X. And similarly, K here we have Ri of x. That's a read operation by transaction I on a piece of data x. And given that the operations are executing in the order indicated, the read operation for transaction I is reading the value of x that was written by transaction k, because it came later. Okay? And then we're also going to have commit operations and abort operations. I'm not going to bother with start operations. The start operation implicitly happens the first time you see an operation by a transaction. Okay, so this is the model that I've been waving my arms at up here, that I'm the data manager. The transactions are running up there, and they're feeding me start, commit, abort, read, and write operations, which I get to execute on their behalf. Don't be put off by the word theory, for those of you who were thought you were taking a systems course. But you do need to be able to abstract these executions in a very simple model, and there is a little bit of mathematical thinking behind this. Just to reiterate something I said last week, I try very hard not to teach exotics in this course. I try to stick to stuff you really need to know to understand how a system really works. And this is one of those things. You've got to be able to grasp this model of executions, or you'll never really understand serializability and how the system is synchronizing access. So the theory is based on a notion of a history as being a model for the execution of a sequence of operations, transactions. So what you see here is a history. And you actually saw some examples last week, but I just sort of gave them to you without a lot of introduction. So here we have transaction 1 reads x, transaction 2 reads x, they both read x, transaction 1 writes x, and then it commits, and transaction 2 writes y, and it commits. Is it serializable? Yes. Yeah, question?
So there's an implied assumption that the value of y doesn't depend on the value of x.
The question is there's an assumption here that the value of y does not depend on the value of x. Actually, it's just the opposite. The assumption is that the value written for y does depend on the value of x, because transaction 2 first read x and it later wrote y. So presumably the value that it writes for y could be dependent on the value that it previously read for x. I don't know. I'm sitting here, I'm just getting the operations, but I know that I saw a read operation from transaction 2 on x, and now I see a write, so probably it used the value of x to figure out what the value of y is.
So this is definitely a problem.
It's a definitely a problem? What's the problem?
The value of x changed in the first transaction, right? And transaction 2 read the value of x before the value changed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's okay. So here's the disturbing... Look. Here's the disturbing part, is that transaction 2 read x before transaction 1 wrote x. So it's as if transaction 2 ran before transaction 1. Even though transaction 2 started later and it finished later, in effect, it ran earlier. Because this execution is equivalent to running first transaction 2 and then transaction 1. Get exactly the same result as this interleaved execution. And that's not a problem. It's weird, I'll grant you that, but it is not a problem. Because those two transactions were submitted to the system concurrently. And if you submit two transactions, if you're at a bank and you know, you and your partner are submitting transactions at two automated teller machines side by side, right? And you both press go at the same moment, what you're doing is you're giving the system permission to execute those transactions in either order. Huh? That's life. That's what you're doing. If you didn't want that to happen, you shouldn't have submitted them at the same time. But you've got to be satisfied with either order of execution. And even if one of them comes back first with an answer, and then the other one comes back later, that does not mean that the one that came back first is the one that executed first. So, you know, there's two things going on here at the same time. One is, I'm trying to get you to accept the fact, first of all, that this correctness criterion of serializability is a little weird. You know, but at the same time, realize that you can analyze it with this very simple execution model. And what you got to do is you got to focus on the relative order of pairs of operations that conflict. In other words, that they don't commute, where the relative order of execution makes a difference. That's what this game is all about. Okay?
Just one more. So is there an assumption that the read through for X will always happen before the read one, the read for X in transaction 2 will always happen before the write of transaction 1?
No. So the question is there an assumption that the transaction 2 is always going to read X before transaction 1 writes X? No. So there's two executions of interest. One is what really happened. What you're looking at here is a history. Chose that word very carefully. History, right? Already happened in the past. What you're looking at here is what really happened. It didn't have to happen this way. It just did happen this way. It could have been, it might have been that transaction 1 wrote X before transaction 2 read X. It could have been that these two executed in the opposite order. It just so happens, though, in this execution, this is the order they really did run. Now, the other kind of history that's of interest is the serial history. And what I want to know is that the history of execution that did happen has the same effect as some serial execution, which is not what happened, but which, as an abstraction, you can imagine that's what happened. The user's model, you know, so here's another way of saying it, is at the automated teller machine, your model of execution is first one transaction runs from beginning to end, all right? Pause. Thousands of other automated teller machines are running transactions. Finally, it's your turn again. Now you run another transaction. While you're running your transaction, you have exclusive ownership of the machine. However, it's understood that the state of the world may have changed between the time you ran your first transaction and the time you ran the second one. Lots of other stuff may have happened. But your abstraction of the system is one transaction executes, a bunch of other people get to run. My next transaction executes, a bunch of other people get to run. I mean, this is why when you do retail shopping, it can be weird. It's like, you know, you run this transaction and it says 3 books left in stock. Sit there and think, is that what I want to do? I don't know. How much money is in my bank account? Go get a cup of coffee, come back. Yeah, what the heck, I'll buy it. And now you run another transaction. I'll buy it. Well, you know, those 3 books are sold. So in between, you were running your transactions serially one after the next, but in between, the world changed. But that is your abstraction. Now, inside, the way the system is going to give you that abstraction is it's going to interleave like crazy in order to make the most efficient use of the hardware, but it will provide that illusion to you as if it's running things serially. So when I say that this has the same effect as running transaction 2 followed by transaction 1, I'm talking about the abstraction. of what, this is the real execution that you're looking at on the screen. The serial execution is the abstraction which I'm arguing, by definition, you should be satisfied with, because you've agreed that serial executions are okay. Might have happened differently, but this is what did happen.
You're not saying anything about consistency in this case. Right.
I'm not saying anything about consistency in this case. That's right. All I'm assuming is that if transactions run serially, I'm trusting the fact that the transactions were programmed so that consistency will be maintained. Because if every transaction maintains consistency, and I, as the data manager, make sure transactions execute as if they ran serially, by induction... Okay. Yeah.
You can set up why there will be peaks, then they shall not be serialized.
Sorry?
You can set up why it will be peaks value.
Yes.
And it will not be serialized.
Correct. If transaction 2 wrote X instead of Y in this picture, the execution is not serializable. And I, as the data manager, so there's actually a third history in this picture. This is the history of what executed. The serial history is the application, the user's illusion of what happened. But the other thing that's going on is I'm sitting here running operations. And at each moment in time, there are the operations I've executed. That's history. And it's the operations that are kind of sitting there waiting to run that somebody has asked me to execute, but I haven't executed yet. And what you want is that when, so at this moment in time, after commit one, let's say I'm the data manager. I ran read one of X, I ran read two of X, I ran write one of X, I ran commit one, and now I've got this operation W2 of X that shows up. The situation is, do not run W2 of X, because if you do, the result will not be serializable. So my job as the concurrency controller is, when I see W2 of X, say, oh, wait a second. No can do. Now remember what I said in the beginning. I said, when an operation shows up, I got three options. I can run it, I can delay it, or I can reject it. This is clearly one of those, reject it, because there's no other choice. I have to reject it. It doesn't matter how long I wait. I could wait, for years, and whenever I run W2 of X, this execution will be non-serializable. So, that's it. Yeah.
But in practice, I'm using this shared database server, and we're all doing transactions, and just because somebody else had to, at that point, happen to be running some other transaction, my transaction is failing now. Your job as a data manager should be minimizing.
Darn it, it's not fair.
Exactly, you have to prevent.
I got here first, I read X. I got here. Let's play it out.
Read it. That's what you
got. Yeah, I got here. You got here first. You read X. And come on now. I want to write X. How come I can't write X?
No,
somebody else ran in between, and it sort of got in my way. Yeah, it could happen.
I think the first write to X that shouldn't have happened, right? Because transaction 2 read X. If you just don't allow that write, if you just made that write wait, right, and then completed transaction 2, and then delayed transaction 1 afterwards, that would have been... What's the trade?
If I was sitting there, and so in a perfect world, where whoever comes first gets priority, and if I know ahead of time what operations I'm going to receive later,
but that's not what I'm
saying. I think there's a theorem about that, but that's not going to work out too well.
At the time you read X, at the time transaction 2 reads X,
all you have to do is just make the write wait, because the read guy has a shared lock on it or something, right? It says nobody can write this until my transaction.
I'm making a joke out of it. Okay. I mean, what you're saying is entirely reasonable.
Okay.
That if transaction one, at the time it did the read, knew that it was going to write later on, and it didn't want to get blown away because some other transaction got in the way, then it should place a reservation on X at the time it does the read to prevent anybody else from getting in the way.
But I think he's saying...
Well, I'm saying the opposite. That's possible too, but I'm saying something else. But yeah, I think they get it.
For you.
He's saying more. He's saying that you can assume that it's going to do the write.
No.
Then you're just trading off throughput for...
Yeah, well, if you assume that everything that's being read is going to be written, then you're going to get very little concurrency.
No, but that's not what I'm saying either. I'm saying at the time transaction 2 reads X, until transaction 2 commits, no one should write to X. That's all I'm saying.
But then it would...
That is the same. What you said is exactly the same as... I mean, okay. You've painted the scenario in a different way, but the effect is the same. Okay. Let's stop, or we're not going to get a second break. Take some time, 5 minutes. So I know the questions are going to keep coming. Save your questions. Go stretch your legs and come back. So that last discussion was interesting and very important, but it's over because I have to get through the next 12 slides or else a homework assignment for this week is going to be a no-op. That's not a good thing for you or for me. All right, so I'm happy to answer questions later, but I think we've, in a sense, you know, this thinking about what if, I mean, that's what this next assignment is about, is going through them and answering that question for a little more complicated examples. And anybody who's really confused, if you have questions, I'm happy to stay after lecture a little bit. If you've got further questions about what we just did, but I have to move on. So, in order to tell whether an execution, a history, is serializable, what I want to be able to do is say that it's equivalent to a serial history. Right? There's the history that happened, and there's the serial history, which is the abstraction for the user, and I want to say that the former is equivalent to the latter. So I need to say what the word equivalent means. I will, and so that's what this slide is about. Two operations conflict if their relative order of execution makes a difference. They don't commute. So a read and a write operation on the same piece of data conflict. Clearly, if they execute it in one order or the other order, it makes a difference. Two write operations on the same piece of data conflict. Not because they write different values, but because the final value of that data is going to be different depending on who writes second. You know, write X, write, you know, transaction 1 writes X, transaction 2 writes X. Final value of X is what transaction 2 wrote. Run them in the opposite order, well, then the final value of X is what transaction 1 wrote. So write operations conflict. Read operations do not conflict because the relative order in which they run makes no difference. Transaction 1 reads X, then transaction 2 reads X, has the same effect as transaction 2 reading first. Right. Two histories are equivalent if they do the same thing. And the technical definition will be, the way I'm going to characterize it mathematically, is two histories are equivalent if the relative order of their conflicting operations is the same. If the relative order of their conflicting operations is the same, that means every read operation read the same input in both histories. And the last write operation into each piece of data is the same in both histories. So every transaction took the same input in both histories. Therefore, since they're deterministic programs, they produce the same output. And the final value of every piece of data is the same in both histories, because the final write operation must be the same if conflicting writes occurred in the same order in both histories. Okay? So they got the same input, they produced the same output, and the final write is the same in all both cases. So they're equivalent. It's just a very long-winded way of, I think, stating the obvious. But
there's a shorter way to say that. They just, both histories, if they're equivalent, they end up in the same state at the end?
Yes. The final state of the data is the same in both histories. So for any given input database, if you run the two histories, they'll produce the same output. And I can say this even without knowing what the transactions are computing. My only assumption is that whatever the transaction writes is entirely a function of what it read and nothing else. Because the conflicting operations are in the same order, it will read the same thing in both histories, and therefore it must write the same thing. So that's the key assumption, is that. Okay, so here are some examples. These histories are equivalent, but let's see what's different about them. History 1 has read 1 before read 2. History 2 has read 2 before read 1. In every other way, they're the same. So clearly, the conflicting, these two operations do not conflict. Therefore, all conflicting operations are in the same order because all other operations are in the same order. Therefore, the execution is the two executions are equivalent. Now, history 2 and history 3, the read operations are in the same order, but the write operations are in different orders. However, they're writing into different pieces of data. Transaction 1 is writing X, transaction 2 is writing Y. These operations do not conflict. So changing their order does not change the order of any conflicting operations. So history 2 and 3 are equivalent. And history number 4 is reversing the order of the middle operations. It's saying the read operation on X and the write operation on Y, we're switching orders. But they don't conflict because the read operation is reading X and the write operation is writing into Y, so it makes no difference which order they run. However, none of them are equivalent to this execution where the write operation on X by 1 precedes the read operation by 2. Notice that in every execution above, we have read 2 and then write 1. Or here we have read 2 and then write 1. Or here we have read 2 and then write 1. And here we have read 2 and then write 1. In all those executions, those two operations which conflict are in the same order. However, in this history, they're in the opposite order, write 1 and then read 2. So all of these histories, H1 through H4, are not equivalent to H5 because of that one change in the relative order. And that's sort of intuitively obvious. Transaction 2 did something different here. It read X from transaction 1 instead of the initial state of X. So, of course, did something different. A history is serializable if it's equivalent to a serial history. Actually, I've said this quite a few times in this course already, but now I actually have a robust definition. It's based on some mathematical model. An execution is a history, so we're no longer dealing about some fuzzy concept of execution. We're dealing with histories. That is our model of what's going on inside the system. And it's an accurate model, because down in the data manager, we are running those operations in some order. So. And we know what it means to be equivalent now. So we know that H1 is equivalent to H4, for example. Those are the same as on the previous slide, and as you can see, H4 is a serial history. So H1 is not a serial history, but it is equivalent to a serial history. Therefore, it is serializable. All right, so now we have a mathematically rigorous way of determining. It's not intuitive reasoning anymore. It's, if you want to tell whether a history is serializable, you got to come up with a serial history in which all pairs of conflicting operations are in the same order as they were in the original one. Now, there may be more than one. There may be more than one serial history that's equivalent to the given history. And in that serial histories, it may be that some transactions are in different orders. But one thing for sure is that the conflicting transactions will be in the same order in all equivalent serial histories, because that's the only way you're going to be able to preserve the relative order of conflicting operations. Right, so here's another example. At this point, it's late night, your eyes glaze over. Let me try to make some sense out of this. So we've still got transactions 1 and 2 reading X. Transaction 1 writes X and transaction 2 writes Y. So in a sense, I haven't changed anything. The order's a little different, but it's the same. Transactions 1 and 2 are the same. But I've thrown in some other stuff. Transaction 1 is now also writing Y. And transaction 3 is now added to the mix, and it's writing into X. So this stuff gets hard to analyze pretty quickly. Is it serializable? Well, what you have to do to answer that question is to look at all pairs of conflicting operations. So, and that's what we're doing down below. So for each operation going left to right, we have to ask, what operation does it conflict with? So R1 of X, if we scan all the way down, we see that it conflicts with W3. So we've got R1 precedes and conflicts with W3. So if we want to come up with an equivalent serial history, that serial history better have transaction 1 running before transaction 3, or it isn't going to be equivalent. Now, the next operation is R2, and we got the same problem there, which is already drawn. So we know that transaction 2 comes before transaction 3. We also see that transaction 2 comes before transaction 1, because R2 of X precedes W1 of X, and they conflict. All right, so what I'm doing, I'm just marching left to right, and for each operation, I'm saying what other operations does it precede and conflict with? All right, do some more. So now we get transaction 1 wrote X, and then later transaction 3 read X. So that says 1 precedes 3. And I'm not going to do all of them. There's one more here shown. This one says transaction 2 wrote Y, later transaction 1 wrote Y. They conflict. So that says 2 precedes 1. So in effect, what I'm doing when I'm looking at all these conflicts is I'm showing what constraints there are on an equivalent serial history. Equivalent meaning that all the conflicts will be in the same order. If I want an equivalent history, it better be that transaction 2 comes before transaction 1, and 2 comes before 3, and 1 comes before 3, and 2 comes before 1. All right? And then I look at that, and I say, wait a minute. 2 comes before 1. Oh, 2 comes before 3. That's okay. 1 comes before 3. Well, is there an order that will satisfy all of this? Well, it looks like it. If I have 2 followed by 1 followed by 3, everybody's happy. Right? 2, 1, 3. 2 before 3, 2 before 1. So this execution is equivalent to a serial execution of T2, T1, T3. Yeah?
Can we ignore R1X before W1X?
Yes. Question is, can we ignore can we ignore conflicting operations within the same transaction? And the answer is yes, because they're not going to limit us in coming up with a serial history. We're going to only be reordering transactions. We can order the operations within a transaction any way we want. So we might, in particular, we can leave the conflicting operations in the same order. Another way to say it is when we're trying to reorder the operations, we're trying to reorder these operations in order to get rid of all these interleavings, right? The kind of things that bother us is the fact that R2 is in between R1 and W1. So we want to get that guy out of the way. You know, the fact that there's never going to be a reason to reorder R1 and W1. I mean, they're part of the same transaction. Once we got them adjacent, we're happy. All right. So what I just showed you is the logic behind building a serialization graph. A serialization graph for a history tells the effective order in which the transactions ran. It is exactly the arrows that you saw on the previous slide. But it's abstracted. So instead of drawing them in the history, we draw them as a separate graph. One node per transaction, an edge between each pair of transactions that have a pair of conflicting operations in that order. So, for example, when we saw that transaction 2 read X and then transaction 1 subsequently wrote X, that says there needs to be an arrow from transaction 2 to transaction 1. And down here, when we saw transaction 1 writing X and later transaction 3 reading X, that meant we had an arrow from 1 to 3. So we draw one from 1 to 3. So we want to draw all the arrows in that graph that are implied by this execution. Clearly, if the graph has no cycles in it, there's a serial execution which is equivalent. So we have a very simple way now of testing for serializability.
So, quick question around. So T1 needs to precede, T2 needs to precede T1, but R1 of X and W3 of X, for example, do conflict. But you pick W.
Oh, you have to do it for all of them. Yeah, so you might argue that there's multiple edges here between some of these. You only need one. So the fact that, okay. So what you observed here is that R1 precedes W3, W1 precedes R3, W1 precedes W3. There are lots of pairs of conflicting operations from those two transactions. But fortunately, they're all going in the same direction. So as long as they're all going in the same direction, we'll just draw one edge by convention. But more edges won't hurt. It's just because they're not going to increase the chances of a cycle. So there's no reason to draw more than one.
So the sake of argument here, for example, if W2 had actually written X.
Yeah.
Now you have two edges. Pretty much. Right? Oh, so it would just wouldn't
depends
be.
Depends on when.
Okay, yeah.
But, yeah.
Edge between T2 and T3, is it unnecessary?
Is it what?
Is it? I think it's unnecessary because we have this relationship between.
It's unnecessary, yeah. Well, it's unnecessary in the.
Doesn't.
Well.
So you can guess at once that T3 should be after T2.
Right. I understand. Yeah, this edge is superfluous, but when we draw this graph is supposed to accurately represent all pairs of conflicts in the execution. So it's a mechanical process. You walk through the history and you draw edges in the graph. And when you're all done, you say, it's got too many edges. I mean, this graph is purely an analytic technique to understand executions. It's not something the system's really going to do. So you're right, you don't need the edge, but.
Yeah, I mean, like if you go and. Its next step will be comparing graphs.
Yeah, if you wanted to do anything with the graph,
it would be unnecessary.
Yeah, it would be unnecessary. Yeah, but. Okay.
Well, I'm just wondering, this is all nice, but you kind of have to know the future, right, in order to...
Yeah. This is not... So. All right. So this is getting weird. I mean, I'm not going to talk about algorithms tonight, and I still have a few more slides I got to get through. But I'm not going to talk about algorithms tonight. I'm talking about the results of executing algorithms without telling you what the algorithm is. It's a strange subject, transaction processing. You just have to trust me that this is the best way of understanding it. When I start telling you about the algorithms, you will reason about the algorithms by thinking about the executions it produces. It's the only one of the, I don't know, maybe there are other areas. It's the only area of computer science I know of where you don't reason about the algorithm, you reason about the executions it produces. So first you got to reason about the executions. Once you get comfortable with that, then when you look at the algorithms, you can think about why it's doing the right thing. Because based on what it's doing, you realize it's going to run this read before that write, and based on what I know about the executions being correct, that'll be okay. So the theorem is pretty obvious. I'm not going to go through the proof, which is that an execution is serializable if and only if its serialization graph is acyclic. Because, you know, if it has no cycles, you can topologically sort it, and therefore, and in fact, there may be more than one topological sort. All topological sorts of the graph are equivalent. They're not identical. The transactions actually may run in different orders. You have two transactions in the graph that are not connected by a path in either direction. Then there's going to be more than one way to order the transactions in the equivalent serial execution, and that's okay. That just says that their relative order makes no difference because they had no conflicting operations. If they had conflicting operations, there would be an edge, and you would be forced to run them in a particular order. So the fact that they can run in different orders shouldn't bother you, because they don't communicate. They don't read or write the same data. It makes no difference what order they run in. All right, so to recap what I just said a moment ago in response to your question, the way we're going to use this is we're going to characterize the set of histories that a concurrency control algorithm permits. And then we can prove that any history with those properties is serializable. And that's how we're going to prove that the algorithm does the right thing, that it produces serializable histories. So we're not going to reason about the algorithm. We're going to reason about the properties of histories produced by the algorithm. And then we're going to say any history that has those properties is going to have an acyclic serialization graph. And in particular, next week, I'm going to prove to you that locking works. Now, I'm sure all of you always thought locking worked because you probably have used it many times in your careers. But I think when you see the argument as to why it works, you're going to wonder what you were thinking all those years, because you really didn't know why it worked. And even after you stare at the proof, it's a puzzle. And it's a short proof. All right, but we're not going to do that tonight. Tonight, I want to finish off by talking a little bit about recovery. I'm going to have to do this a little faster than I would like, but I need to get through it to enable the assignment. So in order to do recovery, there's certain synchronization requirements required in order to get abort to work correctly. So remember, an abort operation undoes the effects of all of the transaction's updates. So what happens if a transaction read one of those updates that you were about to undo? Well, that says that the transaction that did the reading also has to abort. But what if it committed already? Uh-oh. Could that really happen? Well, if we don't prevent it. So here's an example. Transaction 1 writes X. Transaction 2 reads X, and it writes Y. So in order to abort, if we have to abort transaction 1 now, we're going to abort transaction 1. That means this write operation is going to get undone which means this read operation is now invalid, which means we've got to wipe out transaction 2 also and undo its updates. That's called a cascading abort, because the abort of transaction 1 caused an abort of transaction 2. And that's just, you know, if you want histories to make sense, you've got to do that. So, otherwise, I mean, how could you program the system if you didn't do that? If you aborted, if you allowed transaction 1 to abort and transaction 2 to continue and execute and commit, how would you ever write application programs? I mean, how would you know what was being read? It's being, you know, it's reading stuff that never existed. It might be totally wrong. I mean, you aborted the transaction for a reason. Presumably it wrote something bad. All right, so now, to make matters worse, what if transaction 2 commits and then transaction 1 aborts? All right? So the situation now is transaction 1 wrote X, transaction 2 read X. So far, so good. Transaction 2 committed. That looks okay. Except now transaction 1 aborts. And you say, oh, well, it can't abort. What do you mean it can't abort? It's just divided by zero. It's going to abort. I mean, this transaction is not going to commit. Right? So you apparently made a mistake by committing transaction 2 as early as you did. What this says is that a transaction's commit has to follow the commit of every transaction from which it read. So even though transaction 2 was ready to commit at this point, it was, should not be allowed to commit because it read from transaction 1, which has not yet committed. It has to wait for transaction. So the commit, so now we got to delay commits. It's not just enough to worry about the relative order in reads and writes. We now have to worry about the relative order of commits.
But if you delayed the read, it would work, right? If you delayed the commit, why not delay the read, right?
Well, yeah, but of course, the, first of all, I mean, this is, in this example, transaction 2 didn't write anything, but what if it wrote something?
Transaction 2.
Transaction 2. Suppose transaction 2, right in there, it wrote Y.
But it has to do the read first, so if you delay the read until transaction 1 commits.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you delay everything until transaction 1, that's the whole point. You've got to do that. So recoverability says that a transaction cannot commit until all the transactions from which it read have committed. Because if any of them abort, it's going to have to abort too.
Is it not also because it's a condition of serializability? Commit before?
It's got nothing to do with serializability. Even if you were willing, you got to do this. Even if you were willing to run non-serializably, you still have to do this.
If you commit at that point, then it means that transaction R2 should finish before transaction R1.
You worried about this one?
For example.
Yeah.
So if you commit, if you have C2 there, so it means that transaction 2 committed, it means that transaction R2 has to be before transaction 1.
No. No. There's no requirement that the serial execution has to be the same as the commit order. And it turns out that it will be true for all of the practical algorithms that we're dealing with for conflicting operations, but it doesn't, it's, I mean, if transaction 1 committed here, it's fine. I mean, certainly the execution is serializable. It is a little strange, transaction 2 committed before transaction 1, but the only equivalent serial execution is 1 before 2. You know, we keep coming back to these counterintuitive scenarios, but it's perfectly okay. All right, so what this means is that recovery requires synchronization. And in fact, we have to synchronize commits, not just reads and writes. We might have to actually delay a commit in order to make sure that everything's okay. Now, cascading aborts are a mess. You can allow them, but it requires a lot of bookkeeping because you got to remember me, the data manager. I have to remember for every transaction, all the transactions from which it read, because if any of those transactions abort, I'm going to have to abort this transaction too. So all those write followed by read situations are going to have to be, you have to bookkeep them. That's a lot of bookkeeping. Nobody really wants to do that. So it would be, in most systems, you avoid cascading aborts. You just disallow them. And with the way you disallow them is you don't let a transaction read from uncommitted data. So it's not just the fact that transaction two's commit has to follow transaction one's commit. It's that transaction two's read has to follow transaction one's commit. In other words, you only read committed data. If you ever read uncommitted data, you're leaving yourself open for a cascading abort. Because if you read uncommitted data, that is to say data that was written by an uncommitted transaction, there's always the chance that the uncommitted transaction will abort. So if you don't want cascading aborts, you must only read committed data. So this one, you've got a cascading abort. Transaction 2 read uncommitted data, and transaction 1 aborted. So that's a cascading abort. Okay? So a system avoids cascading abort by only reading committed data, and you can easily see that if it avoids cascading aborts, then it's also recoverable. One more definition. It's convenient to undo a write by restoring the old value. In fact, that was shadowing. That's what it was all about, right? You know, and that was the assignment. Assignment one. The way we implemented abort is we restored the old value of the page. Very common thing to do. All right. Let's see how that works. Transaction one wrote X. Transaction one wrote Y. And then committed. And now transaction 2 wrote Y, and transaction 2 read X, and now transaction 2 aborts. It's a serial execution. When it aborts, the value of Y is incorrect because it still has the value that was written by transaction 2. So we have to undo the effect by restoring the before image of Y, the previous value of Y. So that's pretty clear. The amazing thing is it doesn't always work. It seems like it has to work, but it actually doesn't have to work. Transaction 1 in this case wrote X, and I'm putting in values here just so you can really visualize what's going on. Transaction 1 wrote X, and it wrote the value 2 into X. All right, very concrete now. Then transaction 2 wrote X, and it wrote 3 into X. So now we have the original value of X, whatever it was, 0. Then it was overwritten by transaction 1, which wrote 2. And then it was overwritten by transaction 2, which wrote 3. And now transaction 1 aborts. What are you supposed to do? The answer is, well, nothing really, because the fact that transaction 1 aborted, you don't want to undo the update to X because we don't know yet whether transaction 2 is going to commit or abort. If transaction 2 commits, then the abort of transaction 1 is meaningless. It's you're throwing out a write that's getting clobbered anyway. Yeah? All right, so we don't do anything when transaction 1 aborts. What do we do when transaction 2 aborts? Well, we don't install the value that X had when transaction 2 wrote X. We install the value that X had when transaction 1 wrote X. Got that? Transaction 2 aborts, and so we install the before image of X with respect to transaction 1. There's only two write operations in this history. Imagine what would happen if this thing really got complicated. You know, we actually allowed a lot of transactions to run. Imagine the bookkeeping required. Nobody wants to deal with this one. So the answer is you don't overwrite uncommitted data. If you want to implement abort by undoing, by restoring before images, then you just don't ever allow uncommitted data to be overwritten. So this is pretty interesting. I mean, there's just, it's a combinatorial puzzle, right? It's that you can't overwrite uncommitted data because otherwise undo doesn't work. You can't read uncommitted data because then you're going to have transaction cascading aborts if you allow that to happen. You do want serializability, but I haven't told you how yet. There's a lot going on in this picture about getting the right kinds of executions. So final slide is just an example. So we say that a system is strict if it executes a read or a write only if all previous transactions that wrote X are committed. So in other words, strictness implies avoiding cascading aborts. Avoiding cascading aborts implies recoverability. None of them implies serializability, which is independent. Related, but independent. So this execution is strict because transaction 2 overwrote committed data. This execution is not strict because it overwrote uncommitted data. This execution is strict. Transaction 2 wrote Y, and transaction 1 wrote Y, and the commit happened in between. As well, transaction 2 read X from transaction 1, which wrote X, but again, the commit happened in between. So this is strict. However, if I move the commit here, it's not strict. It's still the case that transaction 2 overwrote committed data. However, now we have transaction 1 having read uncommitted data. That allows a cascading abort, and hence is not strict either. All right, so strict implies avoids cascading aborts, which implies recoverability. 9:20, we're done. Any questions before we going once? Okay, so there's no reading essentially for this week, other than I really think it's worthwhile to be able to look at the King's website just to browse around for a little bit. The assignment is just a bunch of these examples. If you understood everything here, it'll go very fast. If not, people put examples down. Understand what's going on there. Therefore, if all goes well, you should have quite a lot of hours this week available to start working on your project, which means understanding shadowing and kind of relating it to steps 1 and 2 of the project design. Okay, that's all. See you next week. Yep.